At this point, when many people should be concerned about their health, and many people are, we felt it was essential to revisit this subject with Dr. Brownstein. So listen, learn, enjoy, and we'll be back next week. This is an encore of the best of the best.
Hi, this is Take Charge Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist, clinician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye!
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health, and I'm here on this absolutely gorgeous winter day with my co-host,
Carol Peterson.
And, you know, Carol made a suggestion, and she said, well, let's talk about salt for our basic discussion of nutrition, the base of nutrition. I said to myself, oh my goodness, salt. How are we going to make a program out of salt? And then... What?
Never fear.
Never fear. So then I just happened to turn on a National Geographic, and there are goats that are walking miles and miles and then crawling up the side of a dam where water leaks out. And they're standing on the side there, I don't know how, because it's totally vertical, licking where water drips out because it's high in salt. Many of them fall, many of them die. So they're risking their lives for salt. And I said, I better pay attention to this. So guess what I did? I looked up Harvard Medical Review, and what did I get? That... Is salt really bad for you? The effect is stronger in people with high blood pressure, hypertension, and Dr. Cook says, but in general, the bulk of research does seem to link lower sodium intake with both lower blood pressure and a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. So here, that proves it. Salt isn't good for us. We have salt receptors on our tongue. Salt was written about 2,000 years ago as an essential element or herbal in flavoring of food. Jesus talks about salt. He talks about salt of the earth, light of the light. So how did all of this come about, and what really and truly is the relationship that salt should have in our lives and in our health? You know, when we talk about health, we don't discuss salt much, do we? Unless we have cardiovascular disease. So we got a special guest today. Carol, could you introduce our guests who will help us get a little clarity on this massive subject?
Well, what better thing can we do than to go to somebody who's written about salt? I'd like to introduce Dr. David Brownstein. He's board certified in family practice and practices in Michigan. And he's a prolific writer. His book, Salt Your Way to Health, is only one of many, and maybe we'll drift a little. He also is a newsletter writer. The Natural Way to Health is his newsletter. And he has a very active blog. So he is really focused on getting information out to everybody. So, Dr. Bronstein, we're so delighted to have you here today.
We really are.
And what got you interested in salt? Maybe we'll start there.
Well, ladies, thank you for having me. So what got me interested in salt? Well, as I, in medical school, I was taught that salt is bad, that there's enough salt in food to supply the body's basic needs, and we don't need to salt anything. And if you use salt, it's going to cause blood pressure problems. And the lower the amount of salt, the better it is for everybody. And I bought into that in medical school, and I bought into that when I started practicing. And then what changed my mind was I started looking at people and realizing that the way I was taught in medical school to treat them, which was to diagnose an illness or diagnose pathology and prescribe the drugs to treat that pathology, I was doing that, just what I was taught in medical school. And what I found was that my patients weren't getting better, that I was having to use more drugs to treat the side effects from the first drugs. And I just realized I couldn't do that. So my first patient was my dad, who was really sick at that time when I was having that crisis of realization that what I was taught in medical school wasn't working in real life. And my dad had his first heart attack at age 40, his second heart attack at 42.
Oh, my goodness.
He had two bypass surgeries and numerous angioplasties over the next 20 years. And by that time, I was 6 months into practicing medicine, different medications to treat diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol, and chronic angina, chest pain that he had for 20-plus years. And my dad was taking nitroglycerin pills like they were candy, you know, multiple times a day. And I was just waiting for the phone call. He was, you know, he passed away. I was finding these drugs were working in my practice. After a few sleepless nights, I remember getting up to get ready to go to work and telling Allison, my wife, you know, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. Granted, I've been doing this 6 months. She looked at me and said, you know, you got to be kidding. We had $90,000 in student loans.
Oh,
and
no.
This is all I wanted to do. Uh-huh. And she said, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't know, but I can't do this. This isn't making people better. She said, well, why don't you do another residency? And I said, that's not going to help. That'll be the same. And she said, well, you'll have to figure out something. And around that time, a patient had given me a book, Healing with Nutrition, by John Wright, who's an allopathic physician. Dr. Wright wrote in his book that heart disease wasn't a medication deficit problem. It was a hormonal nutritional problem. So I read that book. It was my first look into anything alternative. And I started to look at my dad's case. I put him on, based on what I read in that book and just a little bit of research, I put him on two things. I put him on natural testosterone and natural thyroid hormone. Within 7 days, his 20-year history of angina melted away and it never returned.
Oh, my goodness.
Within 30 days, his cholesterol in the 300s fell below 200. He didn't change any of his bad habits to do that. So once I saw the changes in my dad, I realized that's what I wanted to do in medicine. And I started to question everything at that point. I was able to lower my dad's medication load in half very quickly. He looked better. He acted better. He stopped having pain forever. I wasn't worried about getting that phone call anymore after that. And, you know, when I saw the changes in him, I decided that's what I was going to do. And so I started questioning everything. And, you know, my dad was on a low-salt diet at that time. You know, and I was looking at his sodium and chloride levels in his blood work. They were always in the reference range, but in the lower part of the reference range. I did some research on salt and found that there was really no good science behind limiting salt in people's diets. And in fact, if you study the physiologic and biochemical mechanisms of what salt is needed to do in the body, putting someone on a low salt diet will generally raise their blood pressure because it forces the kidneys and the adrenals to release hormones to try and hang on to more salt in the diet. Because salt is such a crucial substance for the body. I told my dad to stop limiting salt and add salt in, and we were able to lower his blood pressure medication use in half at that point. And then I started doing this with my patients, seeing the same results, and you know, that's how that book came to be, Salt Your Way to Health.
Salt is such an essential nutrient all action or motion of minerals to and from into the cells is, salt is a necessary carrier or component of this. And so we're limiting salt. The end result is that we're limiting some of this action.
That is 100% true. We should have over 100 grams of sodium and chloride in our body at any one time. We don't have any stores of these minerals. So either we get them in on a daily basis or we become deficient. The body has recognized the importance of salt as one of the, you know, most crucial substances it must have. It's developed so many mechanisms to maintain adequate salt levels. Some hormones go up when salt levels are low, and kidneys are well suited for getting rid of excess salt and to hold on to salt in salt-deficient environments. Salt is needed, as you said, to usher in all the minerals of the body and to make ATP, the energy molecule of the body. Without salt, we can't do any of that. Limiting salt is, when you study the physiology and biochemistry of the human body, it doesn't make sense. The human body can tolerate a lot of salt if someone's not in kidney failure. Really, the only people that need to limit salt are those in severe kidney failure and severe heart failure, as their bodies are compromised and they have trouble regulating it. For the rest of us, salt is crucially needed and, you know, needed in decent amounts. And I'm frequently telling my patients to increase the salt intake and that their blood work is not indicating they have enough salt.
So, Dr. Brownstein, back to basics. When you're talking about salt, are you talking specifically about salt, sodium chloride, or are you also talking about salts like we have Celtic salt and sea salt and rock salt that are mined from various areas? Which salt are you talking about?
There are differences.
Well, there are big differences.
Mm-hmm.
I was just referring to sodium chloride before, but if you're going to get the best form of salt in the body, it should be combined with minerals that the body needs, since, as you said, salt is a crucial item to help you absorb those minerals. So it's best to get salt in its unrefined form, such as found in Redmond's Real Salt or Salinas Celtic Salt. You know, those contain over 80 minerals along with decent amounts of sodium and chloride, and that's contrasted with refined salt, which we're all used to in restaurants, and Morton salt, that's, you know, thin white stuff.
Yeah.
And the minerals have been removed out of it, and it's just pure sodium and chloride with some toxic additives added to it that we don't need either. So it is important to use the right kind of salt in a diet, and that's the unrefined salt. And in my practice, I generally recommend Redmond's Real Salt or Salinas Celtic Grand Salt.
So that's so interesting. I read a book once, and I think it was also entitled Salt, but it was a history of salt. And the author said that every great city in the world is located where it's located because there was salt
availability.
There.
Interesting.
Yeah, just like those goats going by the dam.
Exactly.
They were looking. Exactly. So I read in that book that Cancun, for example, has a lot of salt from the ocean. They actually cut down all the trees on Cancun so they could evaporate the ocean salt. It was so the salt was more desirable than the trees.
I think there's a balance there that they missed.
Salt has a long history with human existence. We couldn't survive without salt. So you're right. Anywhere there was a big population of humans over 100 years ago, there was a salt deposit. Detroit sits over a salt mine, a salt deposit. Now it's not quite as bad because we have transportation or methods to move things around. So we can get it salt. But the idea of we need to limit salt is beyond ridiculous for the vast majority of us. It actually causes problems. It causes us to get hypertensive and other issues that we need actually, and then we start needing medications for. So there's really no reason to do that.
I've seen studies that show that when we reduce our salt, when we're told to reduce salt, we then begin to sweat out magnesium. We sweat out potassium. We also urinate out more magnesium and potassium. And so our bodies are needing to hold the salt to be able to balance the minerals. And without the cofactor of salt, we start losing essential minerals. We even sap them from our bones because the body's trying to balance the salt and the mineral balance. And so they're showing studies where low salt increases osteoporosis.
Well, you should be able to predict that once you know the physiology of salt and how it's regulated in the body. We need a certain number of salt molecules inside the cell to hold enough water inside the cell to make the cell nice and healthy. When we lose that salt, the cells become dehydrated and water starts flowing out of the cells because there's more minerals in the outside of the part of the cell. The body compensates for that by getting rid of those minerals, like you said. And now you get rid of the minerals, you become dehydrated in the inside and outside of the cells, and the whole idea of this is you're salt deficient, which is causing all of this problem. But that's not the only part. The next part is when sodium levels go down enough, it triggers hormones in the kidneys and the adrenal glands, like aldosterone and renin, to increase. So
those are hypertension hormones.
To take more sodium. The hormones go up. Those are hypertensive hormones, you're right. They raise our blood pressure, but they also go up to help our kidneys absorb more sodium from this low-salt diet that you're doing. So the blood pressure goes up. So then the person doesn't feel good because they're losing their minerals, they're tired, and they go to the doctor, and the blood pressure's up, and the doctor puts them on an anti-renin or anti-aldosterone hypertensive medication, which causes them to lose more salt. And it just perpetuates the problem, and it's just, you're fighting normal physiology and normal biochemistry in the human body. And, you know, unfortunately, that's where modern medicine has gone today. I've gotten so many hypertensive medications by helping them improve their diet, drink more water, and increasing salt in their diet. It's a big part of that. And you started off by saying this is one of the basics. My partners and I always talk about the basics. This is one of the basic things people should do.
And pretty cheap. We're like an ocean inside our own bodies. If you were to go to the emergency room or go to the hospital, the first thing they might do is hang an IV bag, and all it is sodium chloride. First thing they want to do is get electrolytes up and get your body hydrated, no matter almost whatever it is you came in for. And seawater has been used to substitute for blood transfusions because Our blood is actually just like seawater, as salty as seawater. So we sort of have this really intricate design with the earth, with matching our oceans with our bodies.
Now, there are some people that are genetically sensitive to salt, but that's very rare. But they also find salt creates a problem when people are low in potassium. Those are the two incidents of where salt might interfere. I've also seen where a low salt increases your pulse by up to 5 to 10%. When your salt is low, your pulse goes up. Low salt reduces your blood pressure by less than or up to 1%. So the ratio in terms of cardiovascular protection is very limited.
That is 100% true. Go into that literature in my book. And when you really start studying the salt and hypertensive literature, you realize it's almost like the Wizard of Oz with, you know, don't look at that man behind the curtain. You realize it's a big farce. That lowering salt to lower one's blood pressure, it lowers the blood pressure a minuscule amount. Almost non-detectable, you know, from listening and looking at the blood pressure monitor as it, you know, as you're doing someone's blood pressure. The best way to keep blood pressure lower is for people to do the basics, to eat good food, to drink enough water, and to get adequate amounts of salt in to shut down those adrenal and kidney hormones that cause you to raise blood pressure because the body gets dehydrated. It's everything we're talking about.
I'd like to ask you about salt substitutes and what they're actually doing. Your mentor, Jonathan Wright, even introduced what he calls Wright salt, and I believe it's potassium chloride. So many people are advised to avoid sodium chloride and move over to potassium chloride. What's happening when you do that in your diet?
You still need over 100 grams of sodium at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
If you use these salt substitutes, you can make that situation worse. So it's best to use something like an unrefined salt, like we previously talked about, because it's got potassium in it, it's got sodium in it, it's got chloride in it, and it's got over 80 other minerals in it. It's really what the body's looking for in a salt product. When we mess around with things and try and, you know, fool with Mother Nature, that's when we seem to be running into problems with this. And I don't recommend any of those little salts.
Now, we also understand that our brain has almost like a salt thermostat. It wants salt. It wants to create a salt balance. And if our salt is very, very low, that salt thermostat gets hijacked, and it can get hijacked by sugar. It can also get hijacked by drugs. So what they're finding is that you have an increased propensity for addictions when your salt is too low because your brain is craving. Have you been aware of that, or have you seen that at all, Dr. Brownstein?
Well, we've all seen that, because if you ever try to lower your salt intake, people immediately get a craving for salt because we've been designed to crave and require adequate amounts of salt. So when we lower our salt levels down, thousands of reactions in the body get disrupted and altered, and we don't like that. That's why that craving comes into play. It's been interesting that when you look at recommendations over the last 40 years to lower salt intake, people can do it for a short period of time, but after a while they can't stand it, and they start looking for food that has more salt in it. And, you know, that's just because of our design and who we are. It's like trying to run a car without oil in it or without gasoline in it. It's how the cars are designed to run. You know, we need adequate amounts of that stuff for running our cars, and we need adequate amounts of our basic things like salt and water to run our bodies appropriately.
How would you deal with a patient who came to you and with a diagnosis of congestive heart disease, and they're being treated aggressively with
diuretics,
which deplete minerals of all sorts, and getting treated with drugs like digoxin, and they're warned to strictly stay away from salt, and in fact, they're given directions to weigh themselves every day, and if they fall off the salt wagon, immediately they experience some fluid retention and their weight goes up, and cardiologists have put great fear into these people between the scale and the salt shaker. How would you work with a patient like that in that position? Is that person able to find a better way to recover their heart function? When you look at that patient, how would you handle that?
That's not an easy one, and mm-hmm. that takes a lot of work. But mm-hmm.
you're juggling.
At the beginning, salt is fine for most of us, except for those with congestive heart failure and those with renal failure. And congestive heart failure inevitably leads to renal failure and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So these people you got to be careful with, because too much salt, their kidneys can't eliminate it appropriately and they can get overloaded. So they need to have their congestive heart failure treated first. And once that function is fine and if the kidney function is fine, then they can start using salt. But they just need to go a little bit slower and need to be a little bit more cautious with that. But for the rest of us, generally more salt, not more salt, but adequate amounts of salt are what's needed, what's appropriate.
Well, I was reading where low salt and increased triglycerides go together, and insulin resistance and increased stress hormones. All of these go together with very restricted salt diets. And that is actually everything we're trying to counteract. We're trying to lower the triglycerides. We're trying to reduce insulin resistance. We're trying to reduce our stress hormones. And we're asking people to reduce their salt. So how does all this fit together?
Well, I would imagine you probably read that in my book, because I have a whole chapter on that whole aspect.
Well, and, my goodness.
When I lecture on this topic, I go through patients with high triglycerides, you know, insulin resistance, and I say, you know, they have high triglycerides, what do we give them? We give them a statin drug. They have insulin resistance, what do you give them? You give them a diabetic drug. They have elevated blood pressure, you give them a blood pressure drug. And, you know, in the end, I come back to, well, really what they needed was salt for all these problems. And you're right, the body has compensatory mechanisms and responses to low-salt diets, and the responses are generally not good, just as you listed them all. And the one thing with conventional medicine is they have drugs to treat all the surrogate markers, like high triglycerides or high LDL cholesterol and insulin resistance. And these are surrogate markers for low salt in a lot of people. In medical school, I was taught to prescribe the drug to treat the one condition that you diagnose. I was unhappy with that model because I wasn't treating the underlying problem patients were having. Salt goes to the underlying problems of, you know, low salt diets go to the underlying problems of what people have. These patients just need to get their salt levels regulated, and then most of those problems will regulate themselves away.
We're in the cold and flu season right now. It's been very useful. Over the years, I've seen this many times, that if you have a sore throat, you make a salt solution and you gargle with it. Or if you have congestion, runny nose, that you get a neti pot or something similar and make a salt solution and flush out your nostrils and your sinuses. So in this case, is salt actually acting as an antibacterial, antiviral, anti thing, and how is that working?
Well, we know salt has antibacterial properties because our ancestors have learned to
preserve
salt food to preserve it. Mm-hmm. And we've salted pickles and tomatoes and canned foods for probably since the beginning of human existence. To, you know, we learned quickly that that's a way to preserve food. We can preserve meat with salting it and putting it away for long periods of time. So we know it has antibacterial properties to it, and I can tell you that I've used it the ways you're describing it, as, you know, rinsing, you know, sinuses, and it's a wonderful treatment, and it's just one of the basics that people should be doing.
That should be done routinely rather than just wait for a problem. It might be a good preventative to do a neti pot practice, for instance. I know that that's what they teach in a yoga practice, that's a good daily practice.
It is a good daily practice. Certainly a good daily practice for anyone with any sinus issues or allergies or asthma, but I think it's a good issue. It's a good practice for all of us to do.
I recommend to my patients when they say, well, I should limit my salt, I recommend them to salt to cell craving. If you feel like having salt feel good with it, choose a good salt. I like the Redmond's. The Himalaya salt is also good, but it has no or traces of limited natural iodine, whereas the Redmond's has some iodine. The iodine that they put in table salt is potassium iodide, and our bodies don't take it up well. If at all. And so I recommend good salts to craving. I also recommend that if people are going to do extensive exercise, that get a bottle of water and put some high mineral salt in it and drink it about a half an hour before you exercise. And there were some studies about this, and the studies showed that people who hydrated with salt water before exercising were able to exercise for 20 minutes longer than they had been previously. I found that very interesting. My patients find it also interesting when I don't restrict their salt intake. This is Take Charge of Your Health, and we're in the middle of a conversation with Dr. David Brownstein, and we're speaking about something that you think you know all about. But boy, are we learning a lot. And we're speaking about salt. Carol, Dr. Brownstein, and I are speaking about salt, table salt, salt, and the importance it has in balancing our health. So stay right where you are, and we'll be right back. Dr. David Brownstein. And we'll be right back. This is Take Charge of Your Health, and we're speaking with Dr. David Brownstein. We're speaking about salt. He's the author of Salt for Life, as well as 14 other books, a monthly newsletter, and a weekly blog. So we're going right back to the conversation. Carol, myself, and Dr. David Brownstein. Enjoy.
Well, you think about with exercise, you know, the muscles are requiring a lot of energy and ATP molecules to function. And you can't make ATP without the pump to make ATP, and that pump is dependent on sodium. It makes perfect sense that you want to have people with their electrolytes in proper balance before they begin to exercise. And I encourage people to put salt in their water all the time and to sip at that throughout the day. And those who exercise heavily or sweat heavily, to use more salt in their diet. I find the same results in my practice.
You once gave me a tip, Dr. Brownstein. You were saying use 1.5 to 2 teaspoons full of salt every day and actually measure out your daily allotment. Make sure you use it up. And so,
you know, that's my standard line.
So that's what I've been doing, actually, first thing in the morning. Now, having said that, I'd like to ask you, so what I do first thing in the morning, which I think you also recommended, just put some salt on a teaspoon and let it melt in your mouth and then follow up with water. We are also just talking about putting some salt in your water and drinking it already dissolved. So there's more than one way we can do this. Is one preferable or over the other, or the bottom line is get the salt in however you can?
The bottom line is get it in. If people don't like salty water to drink it, which that salty water taste goes away after a couple of days, but if they don't like the salty water taste, they can put in empty capsules and just fill them and take them as a pill. But the bottom line is get adequate amounts of salt in, whether you want to salt your food, your water, or just take it as a supplement. Bottom line is just maintain adequate amounts of salt.
Yeah, when I was growing up, my brother was big into football in Southern California. So it could be 100 degrees while they were in their uniforms and the hats and everything out there exercising strenuously. And we know that the body uses can release a half teaspoon up to a teaspoon per hour of heavy exercise. And so when the boys would get these heavy cramps in their legs, they'd be running and exercising, they'd fall over holding their legs. The coach would come and give them salt pills, and it would go away immediately. Salt pills and water. And we used to watch that. Now, they can't give salt pills. They can't give anything. So some of the mothers are buying salt pills, and the kids carry them.
So if there's cramping anywhere in the body, that should be a signal that you're low in salt. And that's what I tell my patients, that you should, a light should go on in your head, hey, I need more salt. I have a leg cramp or a foot cramp or something like that. You're simply not taking in enough salt for your muscular demands at that time. I tell patients if they're sleeping at night and they wake up with leg cramps or foot cramps to just start taking salt, a quarter to a half a teaspoon with a little bit of water, and usually the cramps will go away immediately. But you should take in enough salt so you don't get cramps in the first place.
Uh-huh.
It's nearly 100% effective at treating pretty much any type of cramps. You know, you don't need any fancy quinine medications. You just need salt for that.
I've been reading more and more about hydration in the body and the importance of our fascia and transmitting signals. And if you're not hydrated, that's not going to happen. You need minerals to maintain that hydration. I would think salt is probably right at the top of it. I'm thinking about this whole thing is about the body electric. We are electric being, and we have all this energy, really our chi, as it's called in yoga and other philosophies. Our very energy and our very life, is that not totally dependent on minerals and hydration from water?
Sure it is. You started off by saying, let's do the basics. The basics are maintaining adequate hydration. Number two is maintaining adequate salt levels. And three would probably be eating a good diet. And, mm-hmm. We need hydration. We need salt. They go hand in hand. You need salt and water to balance the two oceans of the body, the inside of the cell ocean and the outside of the cell ocean. If we don't have enough of either, we got problems. Salt helps you hold into water, helps hold that water in the body better. We need to drink adequate amounts of water to, balance the salt. That is considered the basics. You know, we drink too many other substances, and soda that has caffeine in it that pulls water out of us, or too much sugar in juices and things that pulls water out. So we should just go back to the basics, which is maintaining hydration and maintaining adequate amounts of salt in the diet.
Also, cosmetic. I noticed that older people in particular, if you look at their face, it's like a desert with all these little tiny wrinkles. Would that not be a prime sign for this body is pretty dehydrated?
Older people can become dehydrated in a flash. So their kidneys and adrenals don't respond as fast to maintaining salt and hydration as when they were younger. So that is really crucial for older people to drink adequate amounts of water and to take in adequate amounts of salt, because they can become dehydrated, they can become hyponatremic or really low sodium so quickly that, they're into major health issues in an incredibly fast time period. So absolutely, one of the signs will be the skin will get more wrinkled and tongue will look like a piece of carpet and their eyes start looking, very dry and are suffering from dry eyes.
They also get very dizzy. Very dizzy. One of the symptoms of being dehydrated is very dizzy from sitting to rising because they don't have enough fluid circulating. They don't have enough blood volume, and the fluid balance is balanced by sodium.
I'd like to bring
other things.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things old people always complain about is they're constipated. And they get constipated because they don't have enough water in their system to, lubricate their bowels. It becomes like cement in there. For older people, it's just even more crucial they maintain adequate hydration for the reasons you mentioned and for things like constipation.
This is very interesting that such a short talk that I thought would be so short about sodium and the importance of sodium or lack of sodium. And here we are all this time, all these effects, every cell in the body.
I'd like to bring up intermittent fasting, which has become very popular, and I think in a good way, because it's helping people get rid of their insulin resistance and stop the progression to diabetes and hypoglycemia and prediabetes, which are all serious health problems. So when people go on a fast, I've been seeing that after a few days, if they don't pay attention to having enough salt, they're in trouble and their heart rate goes up, they feel weak and they can't keep up. So everybody's advised to have some bone broth, salt the bone broth. What's happening here is people are not eating food, they're not doing anything else except for maybe water for water fast, and they're it sounds to me like they're hitting a wall with particularly the adrenals involved when you get this rapid heartbeat and dizziness like Corinne brought up before. What should you be doing if you're doing an intermittent fast as far as salt is concerned?
I always tell my patients, if you're going to do that, then you got to make sure you stay hydrated. You need to maintain adequate amounts of salt while you're staying hydrated. They go hand in hand. So it's just as we've been talking about. They can still eat salt, still take water as they're hydrated, mm-hmm. as they're fasting. That's a big problem for people because they can quickly become dehydrated and salt deficient, and particularly if they're older. It happens really fast. Older people do not tolerate that stuff very well.
So whenever I think of you, Dr. Brownstein, I think of iodine. So this is a little bit of a segue here in that when people exercise, they lose salt. They can lose a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon of salt. But when they lose salt, they also can lose iodine. They can lose the RDA amount of iodine in an extensive exercise. We're depending on iodine to get our iodine from salt. And what happens is that when the salt sits on the shelf for months and years, etc., that iodine can precipitate out and dissolve. So you're really not getting iodine from your salt. Now, can you answer those? They're semi-questions, but could you give us more understanding of those phenomena?
Well, the first thing I studied in this relationship was salt. You know, then I started studying iodine. And I was taught in medical school that iodine deficiency was a thing of the past. It was rectified with the use of iodized salt. Nobody needs to take iodine because it causes thyroid problems, and we get enough iodine in our food, so just nobody needs to take it. Well, that's another myth that I was taught in medical school, because when I started checking people's iodine levels, I found the vast majority, over 98%, were significantly low in iodine, most super low in iodine. The government's own studies have shown iodine levels have fallen over 50% over the last 40 to 50 years, and the vast majority of our population is iodine deficient. These limiting salt also limits iodine. Iodine was put into refined salt in the 1920s to treat the goiter epidemic, which was affecting the Midwest United States. It was an effective public health measure at that time. It did get rid of goiter in the vast majority, which is a swollen thyroid, but it didn't provide enough iodine for the rest of the body. Studies that I've done over the years with Dr. Abraham, who was my mentor on iodine, we found that the vast majority of iodine in refined salt is not bioavailable. It's only about 10% from studies dating back 40 years ago. 10% of iodine in iodized salt is bioavailable. You're right. The longer the iodine sits in that iodized salt, the more of it sublimates out to a gaseous phase and just leaves the product. So iodized salt is an effective way to prevent goiter, but it's not an effective way to provide enough iodine for the rest of the body. And this iodine deficiency epidemic is affecting us in many ways. Iodine is needed to maintain the normal architecture of the glandular tissue, which includes the thyroid, the ovaries, the uterus, the breast, prostate, and the pancreas. What are we having problems with now? We're having problems with all those tissues. The number one fastest growing cancer in the United States is thyroid cancer. 1 in 7 women have breast cancer. 1 in 3 men prostate cancer. We have pancreatic, ovarian, uterine cancer growing at epidemic rates. We have 1 in 3 men with prostate cancer. My hypothesis has been for years that the reason we're seeing such a large rise in these cancers and we're not making progress in these areas because we're not treating the underlying cause of the problem, which is iodine deficiency. Unless we, again, go back to physiology and biochemistry, we're going to continue to make the same mistakes of, you know, just treating the symptoms of the illness, not treating the underlying cause.
Now, Dr. Teitelbaum, Jacob Teitelbaum, he said on our program once, he said, if anybody comes up, he said specifically because we were speaking about breast cancer, with a diagnosis of breast cancer, the first thing I tell them to do is take high-dose iodine. Now, how does that affect cancer or any irregular tissue, the high-dose iodine? Can you explain that to us, please?
Well, animal test tube and human studies have shown that we need iodine to maintain the normal architecture of those glandular tissues. And that, I mentioned that, the breast, ovaries, uterus, prostate, and pancreas, and thyroid. And in iodine deficiency, you first get cysts forming in these tissues. If the cysts go on longer, the cysts become hard and nodular. If it goes on longer, they become hyperplastic. Mm-hmm. And cancer is the end result of that iodine deficiency epidemic. Now, in animal test tube and human studies, it's been shown that iodine can not only halt that progression, but can reverse it. So I think Dr. Teitelbaum's right. But I also say we should be treating people before they develop these illnesses so they'll have a less chance of developing these illnesses. Iodine should be used from before women become pregnant with their child and onward with infants and children and teenagers and everything. You know, we should all be using iodine throughout our lifespan, adequate amounts. And our iodine requirements have gone up over the years. They haven't gone down because our exposure to toxic halogens, which include fluoride and bromide, which can competitively inhibit iodine out of the body, have gone up over the years, not gone down. So our iodine requirements are actually higher than our predecessors, and it's occurred at the same time that our iodine intake has declined. And that's led to that double whammy of why 1 in 3 men have prostate cancer, 1 in 7 women have breast cancer, and thyroid, pancreatic, ovarian, uterine cancer, all growing at epidemic rates, is what we're facing right now.
I've known for a long time that low iodine in pregnant women lowers the brain development or the ability of the brain to develop. We've known that forever. So it's funny, Carol, you were going to say something that I was going to tell something that I do in my home, but go on, Carol.
Oh, I was just going to say there's a controversy that you're up against very frequently, Dr. Brownstein, in how much iodine is enough iodine for somebody to be using. And on you're on generous amounts of iodine, and the other side is the recommended daily allowance, the RDA, which is quite small. I know you've been criticized with this over and over and over again, but you maintain your position. When you think about what you just were talking about, all these tendencies toward cancer, it would seem apparent that whatever it is, we need a lot more iodine in our diet, one way or another, than we're able to get.
So I have received a lot of carping and from the world as well as from the holistic world. But I can tell you the reason I maintain my position is because I've been seeing patients for the last 25 years, and I've been testing them, and I've been following them and their iodine levels, and their salt levels, and their thyroid levels. I can tell you what works and what doesn't work in my practice. And this works, and it's treating a problem that's easily diagnosed if you do the proper testing. those who are criticizing it either don't understand physiology and biochemistry or seeing patients. Because if you're seeing patients, you'll see the vast majority do with this therapy, and it makes biochemical sense and physiologic sense when you study it, and you've got the laboratory data to back you up on it. So doctors are not easy people to
teach.
Thought iodine was a toxic substance for people, and I didn't prescribe it. I was interested in it, and I was looking at it, but there was no testing for it, and I, you know, it'll surface every once in a while if you Google my name, that iodine, you know, there's a quote you'll see from me. Iodine is like putting fuel on the fire to those with Hashimoto's disease. And that was my thought process the first 10 years, but I became educated about iodine, and I started doing the testing on it, and I can tell you that really not, that wasn't a true statement that I made. That was a false statement and fake news statement. And, you know, I become wiser because I've done the testing, and I treat my Hashimoto's patients with iodine, and their disease generally does better and many times goes away.
How much iodine? How much iodine are we talking about for a Hashimoto's patient?
Well, everyone's different, but the average patient, about 25 milligrams of a combination of iodine and iodide a day, in our toxic world, is probably adequate. However, if they have glandular disease, breast, ovaries, uterus, prostate, thyroid, pancreas, they probably need a little bit more. And for those with cancer of those tissues, they may need, you know, hundreds of milligrams of iodine a day to help stem that tide. But with the proper testing and the proper holistic treatment, iodine can be a great part of any holistic treatment regimen.
So it's always a pleasure. I just want to tell you what I do to increase iodine in my family without another pill. Oh, my goodness. So I always get a good seaweed, and I make a lot of broths. Every day I have a broth cooking in my house. And I throw, and it imparts no flavor other than a slight saltiness, which is what I like. I always put one or two pieces of seaweed into my soup as it's cooking to hopefully give it a little bit of iodine. But I also go, and here I am, I look like a bag lady. I've got a big coat, you know, and a big hat and gloves and boots, and I'm walking along the beach with a big plastic bag, raking up the seaweed and putting it into the bag. And I use seaweed as a mulch over my garden. So hopefully I'm getting the minerals and I'm getting the iodine into the soil. Now, I live by the water. We all do here in New York area. But even still, I feel that I'm imparting more iodine into the soil that is able to be utilized by the plants. What do you think, Dr. Brownstein? Is this just a ritual?
That's how the Japanese do it.
Oh.
That's how the Japanese do it. They fertilize their crops with it, just like they're doing. And Dr. Abraham and I did a study where we estimated that the Japanese take in about 15 milligrams of iodine per day from their diet, primarily from fertilizing, you're doing it, you know, fertilize their crops with seaweed. Oh. And seaweed is part of their daily diet. And in the U.S., on the other hand, we get in maybe 150 micrograms, probably less than that per day. And they're getting in 100 times what we get in. And they have markedly less breast cancer, prostate cancer, thyroid cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, you know, so on, than we do. And it's because of their increased iodine intake. So I think that's a good way to get it in.
Thank you so much. I love when you come on the show. I always learn. I know the audience does. We always have fun. It's just wonderful. Thank you so much, Carol.
I really like to encourage people to look at your website. You've got all your books posted there, and they are all a treasure. For the average patient, the average person, there's so much to learn, and I know you turn to writing books because you can't possibly give your patients all that information in one sitting. So it's quite the library now, and would you tell everybody your website and how to contact you with questions?
My website is drbrownstein.com, drbrownstein, B-R-W-N-S-T-E-I-N. I have 15 books. We have DVDs, and I write a newsletter, as you mentioned before. And, you know, the reason I started writing it was when I started doing this work, I was spending a lot of time educating patients on this, and I figured that they need to read more about it and know where I'm coming from, and that's why I started writing it. And I wrote it for patients, and I wrote it for practitioners, too. You know, I write about what works in my practice, and I can tell you, iodine works, and salt works.
Thank you so much, and it's always amazing how fast an hour goes by when we're learning and enjoying. So thank you so much. And
thank you, ladies.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
And bye-bye. We'll be back next week. Bye. Bye-bye. In conclusion, I'd like to say, remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. You can hear this program in its entirety on my Facebook, Corinne Fornari, RPA, CCN, or on Take Charge of Your Health Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health. My website is fornarihealth.com, and my office number is 212-219-0700. That's 212-219-0700. And I know many of you noticed that beautiful music, a big change. My brother's group wrote it for me. Left Hook from Redding, California. Their website is Redding Left Hook. Really special. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.